This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Wednesdays from 3:30 to 6 a.m. only on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, broadcasting throughout the tri-state area and streaming live throughout planet Earth on WBAI.org.
Well, hi, it's 12 midnight in New York. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Anne-Marie Henriksen, and please stay aboard for the next 90 minutes.
By the sea, I have walked under moon and stars, skyscrapers shone in their dark majesty. In this otherworldly land of ours, I've walked by the buildings, I've walked by the malls, I've walked by the skyscrapers. Lonely and dark in the lonely financial zone by the sea. I have walked under moon and stars. By the sea, I have walked on cold winter nights. I've stood in awe so silently under the buzzing electric light. Boats in the harbor, gulls on the pier, ships and trucks and sailors in the bars, in the lonely financial zone by the sea. I've often walked under moon and stars.
Listening to
what you were listening to.
Yeah, but I don't know what it.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for supporting WBAI. Amazingly, some people aren't thrilled about having you support us. I don't know why that would be, but I'm going to be returning to that idea later in the program. Hi, welcome to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Anne-Marie Henriksen, and I'm I have done this show for a long period of years, but I've been off for a while, and I'm filling in right now for Bill Weinberg, who is on assignment in Peru, and I hope that he is fine, since things, as you know, can sometimes go poorly when one is traveling. So I'm hoping that he's going to come back with an exciting adventure story for us, and not one that is like entirely too exciting. I have one announcement to make. I mean, I guess I should have other announcements to make, but I only know of one, which is that next week, Wednesday, September 9th at 8 p.m. at the B.B. King Blues Club on 42nd Street. I'm sure all of you who have listened to the station for a while are know of the great Moogie Klingman, who is a great friend of the station, been associated with the station for a long time, and has played with all kinds of famous musicians over his career, most prominently Todd Rundgren in Utopia. He was the keyboards player for Utopia. He's also played with everybody from Bob Dylan to Jimi Hendrix to Bette Midler. But he's going to be playing next Wednesday with someone that to me was a rather unexpected musical partner for him, Sanjaya Manjarkar of American Idol, who is going to be celebrating his 20th birthday at B.B. King's Blues Club. And I'm telling you, if I were not working next Wednesday night, I would so be there, because I can't even wrap my mind around what this is going to be. Although apparently, Moogie and Sanjaya have known each other for years. This is not a kind of like a stunt, performance in any way. One of the other peaceniks in Moogie's band produced Sanjaya's EP, which you can obtain from him. And I can't say what the cost is, but it's about the price of a movie. And for the price, this is going to be something you could tell your children and your grandchildren about, really, for the price of a movie. So if you are available next Wednesday night around 8 p.m. to go to B.B. King's club, I would say you should definitely check out Moogie Klingman and the Peaceniks with Sanjaya Manjarkar and celebrate Sanjaya's 20th birthday.
Well, we're going to have to schedule an early end to the board meeting on next Wednesday in that case.
I guess we will. I just think this is outstanding. So I'm... This is, as I said, this is a team-up I never saw coming. So I'm sure it's going to be an interesting show, and I hope we hear back from people who do go and tell us what it was like. So for tonight, I have been filling in for Bill, but I was on vacation last week. I decided last week that I was going to do... personal things that I don't always get a chance to do, and not coming last week. And Bill gave, of course, had recorded a show, which we played, and it was, of course, a great show, as is no surprise. And when I take vacation, I mean, it's nice to be able to go out of town, but I'm not the traveler that Bill is or that Peter Lambert Wilson was. I just, in a way, I'm just not enthusiastic about traveling in the way that they are. I mean, I have traveled Denver places and had a good time and remember it fondly, but I really like the kind of vacation, in a way, where you get to stay home and travel around New York in a way that you never get to do when you're here, because you're always working. At least in my case, I'm always working, so I don't always get a chance to do things and go around during the day and see the stuff that I would like to see if I were not working. And one of the things I did was one of my favorite things to do in the city, which is I went to visit the Bronx Zoo, which is one of my absolute favorite things to do. Now, I know that there are criticisms of the whole idea of a zoo, and I'm aware of it, and every time I go, I'm a little more aware of, the validity of it, but I don't care. I'm kind of an addict on this question. I really, really, really love to see different animals that I would never see otherwise, and so the way you're going to see them is in a zoo. And the zoo also itself has a kind of, mixed... It has a mixed personality on this question. The very fact that they tried to change their name, a couple of years ago to the Bronx Wildlife Conservation Center, whatever else that they were trying, that They also felt that the word zoo had a set of bad connotations that they were trying to get away from. And, in fact, everybody just called it the Bronx Zoo anyway, and they felt that I believe that their fundraising went down, so they went back to the name Bronx Zoo, which, in fact, more accurately described what they were actually doing up there in the Bronx. And I support what they're doing up there in the Bronx. I like going to the zoo, and I like seeing the animals. But, of course, if you, like me, like going to the zoo, I bet you have a similar set of problems with going to the zoo. The big one being, isn't it rough going to see all these animals, all these howler monkeys, like, running alongside you, like, banging on the glass and screaming obscenities and shining bright lights into, like, dark exhibits and, like, rushing out screaming at each other? I mean, it's just, it's very, very hard enjoying yourself with people that just don't, it's hard to see why they went to zoo in the first place if they didn't really want to see an animal. And this isn't new. There is nothing about this that is different from the way that the zoo has ever been set up. In fact, I know from my own readings on the history of zoos and wildlife parks that probably, if anything, things are probably better now than they were 100 years ago. It's one of the few things where you could say that there really has been some real progress and some real development, and that even, you know, members of the general public, you know, like dummies, you know, like me, know better than to go and, bang on the glass and scream at the animals. But still, when you go up there, it is just rough to be in a place where they have deliberately set the lighting down low so that you could see something unusual, like I can't remember the name of it, but this, Filipino deer-like rodent. You know, it's quite a large thing. It's really kind of like a guinea pig with very long, skinny legs. It looks like a little deer. It's a deer, they call it a deer mouse, but really it's a kind of a rodent. And no, not an alpaca. The point is that it's only really active at night, and, you know, people come in and they need immediately to come in and take a picture of it, so they're flashing their camera at it, or their phone at it. And has it not occurred to anybody who goes in there that maybe they have this exhibit set up with dim lighting because the animal doesn't want to have a lot of flashing lights, like, going off over its head all the time? And, in fact, in this exhibit, the animal was sitting with its paws over its eyes and its back to the glass, which is, you know, sad. Very sad. Very sad for the poor little thing. One of the things that has changed in the Bronx Zoo in the last year, apparently with all the big shifts of money, is that they have shut down one of my favorite exhibits from when I was from just forever, called World of Darkness, which was the exhibit where they had a lot of things just like that, where you could see animals that mostly would be nocturnal, and they had them under different kinds of infrared light, so that they wouldn't experience themselves as being under daylight, and they would walk around in their enclosure in a comfortable kind of way without being aware that they were being looked at. And I really have no idea why they shut this down, but apparently in the big budget cuts, this is one of the things that they chose to get rid of. And I don't know why, but I kind of have to wonder why, without having looked into the question at all, if the whole thing of people coming in with their cell phones and flashing lights into the skunk and the sloth and the raccoon and the tree shrews and everything else that, you know, lived in World of Darkness had something to do with why the whole exhibit became less popular, because the animals were always, like, fleeing from these bright shining lights going off in their faces several, you know, times a minute. And the other thing that struck me when I was there is, you know, people that would show, not just do what I've just described, but they're, in every exhibit that there was someone who was shoving their phone or their camera up to the exhibit without even really looking at it. They were kind of looking out of the corner of their eye at the viewfinder and then going on to the next thing. They take an image and then go on to the next thing, and they were looking at the, and they were right in the place. They were right in the area where they could look the animal in the eye, look right at the animal, and yet they were more interested in taking an image of it and going on to the next experience. And I understand that in some ways the zoo design kind of encourages this in the sense that it has a very large number of things to see in a short period of time. And that people have this whole kind of, you know, the whole thing that people do in a museum. They have the 5 seconds they spend in every painting, you know. Da, 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 da. Okay, on to the next one. I've done it. I'm done. I'm immune. I'm on to the next one. And that now that people can do it through a phone, there's no reason really, you know, not to just keep taking images and experience the whole thing afterwards, after they're out of the whole place entirely. But it seems sort of nutty. You know, if it had been there on a Wednesday when it's free, it would have made more sense to me. But we went on a Monday when you have to pay to get in. So people paid money to get in there, and they're trying to, you know, not have the experience. Why would you do this? And even as I'm saying this, I realize, you know, it's not just that I sound like a cranky old curmudgeon. It's that I also realize that any kind of photographer is always going to be experiencing something sort of at a distance. You know, they're going to be looking back and seeing a shot and taking it. So I'm criticizing, you know, someone's desire to experience the world as an artist. Yes, I am. You know, there is sort of a problem with it for me, no matter how good they are with it. Because I'm not, just because these people come in and doing it on a phone and a camera, I don't know that they're not great photographers. For all I know, they're taking, you know, fantastic pictures with the, you know, the phone and the camera. And yet I still feel that there's something missing with someone always sort of, you know, not being here now, you know, to use an old phrase, you know, to always sort of be experiencing life at such a distance. And it bugged me no matter how much I love the zoo, and I do love the zoo. I love animals. And not, you know, it doesn't matter how politically incorrect you tell me the zoo is. I don't care. I'm going to go anyway. And I'm gonna love it anyway, even though I know that, you know, perhaps they're not doing everything for wildlife conservation that they should, and blah blah blah. They should do more, and the zoo should be better. But I'm just never gonna get to the point in my life where I don't really just fall apart going to get to see a tapir lying down by a big body of water on a bank of sand. That's because otherwise I would never get to see it. And I just think it's one of the, no matter how wrong it may be, it's a wrong thing that I believe in a big way. So I believe that I acknowledge, I guess I'm saying, it's that I too am part of the problem. I'm not trying to sort of look down on other people for trying to live the urban life and, you know, live in a city and yet get the advantages of living in the country. Yes, it's no. I know that it's not really possible. I know that it's sort of like something that is not, I'm asking a lot of something that can't really be done, but, and yet I'm asking it to happen. And I'm happy when someone makes it work for me. And sometimes I'm willing to not look too carefully at how it happens because I'm so enthralled with the results. So, yes, I repeat, again, I am part of the problem. But, so I had this sort of going in my mind this whole last week of this whole idea of being sort of separated from your primary reality and being happy about it. And last night when I was listening to the board meeting, and of course, all of you who are listening, who are listeners, and I hope you are paid-up listeners, the election is important. You should be taking part in it, and please do vote. And I'm happy that the station is taking the election seriously enough to be having these kinds of things on the air so that you can hear what's going on. And I will also say that, you know, Bill Weinberg and I, having shared this space for a long time, we're like we're a candy mint and a breath mint. We're two great tastes in one. Not always quite the same thing. And Bill has some ambiguities about the latest changes that have taken place at the station. I do not. I think that the changes are great. And I, you know, this is a provisional statement, and if things go wrong later, then of course I will take a strong stand against trying to make them be better again. But I think there have been a lot of crummy things happen here for a long time, and the recent changes that have happened in the last year or so are changes that needed to happen for a long time, even if sometimes it was not obvious to people listening from the outside. It's really, really, really an important thing. And so, because I feel strong about the things, I was listening to the candidate statements last night on the whole station board presentation that was on the air last night. And one of the people called in, and I apologize to you in advance because I don't know who you are, and I know you're not here to defend yourself, but some guy seemed to have quite a bee in his bonnet about Jane Fonda doing promos for the station, because 20 years ago she was married to Ted Turner and went to an Atlanta Braves game and did the tomahawk chop or whatever the thing is that they do at their games. I hate the Braves, whatever. I hate them for other reasons. And which many people see as sort of an anti-Native American thing, or at least at best sort of as, you know, a stereotypical idea of Native American behavior from a long time ago. And the only thing I could think was, I mean, this woman can't win for losing. I mean, it's just, you know, there's the guys calling into Rush Limbaugh, you know, about how she sat in a North Vietnamese aircraft cockpit 40 years ago. And then there's a guy calling into BAI, equally angry and equally going on at length about how she, like, went to a baseball game with her then husband and participated in a sports cheer of questionable taste, you know, 20 years ago. And people still won't let it go. And I just keep thinking, would people be so unwilling to let it go if she were like a mousy little thing, you know? Isn't it just that she's 70 years old and she's still hotter than your girlfriend? I mean, you put yourself, you know, an actress by definition puts herself in a very sort of exposed position and opens herself to certain kinds of fantasies. And then if she ever does anything that sort of doesn't quite meet the grade, then people are so willing to tear her apart. And I've been so kind of, it's just something that I've been thinking about over, you know, the recent couple of years, I guess everyone has, that the certain kinds of, I mean, the phenomenon itself is not new. It's not that we've discovered a new way of being human. We're being the same way of being human, but there's certain ways of expressing nastiness and human malice that seem to happen much faster now in the days of the internet than they did before. And one of them is the kind of chewing up and spitting out of pretty young girls who, you know, who embody a certain kind of female fantasy for people. I mean, it used to be that at least they got a couple of years, and now they often just get a couple of months because you can almost, like, chew them up and spit them out at the speed of human thought because they're going on a computer, at least before. Like I said, you know, it's not new. I mean, certainly it happened before in the days of newspapers and the radio and TV and everything else. But it just seems like I can't even catch my breath, like, you know, reading at the ups and downs of people, you know, like, you know, Britney Spears and Lindsay Lohan and Jessica Alba and Jessica Biel and, you know, whatever. Just, you know, fill in the blanks. All the girls that are supposed to be the fantasy girls. And, of course, they're the fantasy girls until they're not. And then they're lower than just a regular girl. And I am not so much, I'm an unreconstructed enough old-time feminist to find this really disturbing. And I just feel like people's, like, piling all on Jane Fonda is an example of it as well. The same people are coming down. It just seems like another example of the kind of thing that people do, you know, to someone like, the, you know, some poor little thing like Lindsay Lohan or Britney Spears is the same thing you're doing to, you know, an Oscar, you know, an Academy Award-winning actress like Jane Fonda is not, you know, immune from it either. And it just seems... it just seems crazy to me. And it made me remember something that, a story that made a big impression on me when I was in high school. And unlike a lot of things in high school, it still holds it really well for me. And I've thought over the years of reading it at other times, and I always felt like, well, it takes a long time, I'm not going to read it. And I realized, you know what, tonight I do have the time to read it, and so I'm going to read it for you. And it's a story, of a famous one, perhaps the story that made James Tiptree Jr. famous. It's called The Girl Who Was Plugged In. And I think it's very much about girls and the media and women and what we expect from them. And I'm going to start now. Listen, zombie, believe me, what I could tell you, you with your silly hands leaking sweat on your growth stocks portfolio, one-town lousy hacks of AT&T on 20-point margin and you think you're Evel Knievel. AT&T, you double-knit dummy, how I'd love to show you something. Look, Dead Daddy, I'd say. See, for instance, that rotten girl in the crowd over there, that one gaping at her gods, one rotten girl in the city of the future, that's what I said. Watch. She's jammed among bodies, craning and peering with her soul, yearning out of her eyeballs. Love. Ooh, love them. Her gods are coming out of a store called Body East. Three young bloods, larking along loverly, dressed like simple street people, but... smashing. See their great eyes swivel above their nose filters, their hands lift shyly, their inhumanly tender lips melt. The crowd moans. Love! This whole boiling megacity, this whole fun future world loves its gods. You don't believe gods, Dad? Wait, whatever turns you on, there's a god in the future for you, custom made. Listen to this mob. I touched his foot. Oh, I touched him. Even the people in the CTX tower up there love the gods, in their own way and for their own reasons. The funky girl in the street, she just loves. Grooving on their beautiful lives, their mysterious problems. No one ever told her about mortals who love a god and end up as a tree or a sighing sound. In a million years, it would never occur to her that her gods might love her back. She'd squash against the wall now as the godlings come by. They move in a clear space. A holocam bobs above, but the shadow never falls on them. The store display screens are magically clear of bodies as the gods glance in and a beggar underfoot is suddenly alone. They give him a token. Ah, goes the crowd. Now one of them flashes some wild new kind of timer and they all trot to catch a shuttle just like people. The shuttle stops for them. More magic. The crowd sighs, closing back. The gods are gone. In a room far from, but not unconnected to, the GTX tower, a molecular flip-flop closes too, and three account tapes spin. Our girl is still stuck by the wall while guards and holocam equipment pull away. The adoration's fading from her face. That's good, because now you can see she's ugly of the world. A tall monument to pituitary dystrophy. No surgeon would touch her. When she smiles, her jaw, it's half purple, almost bites her left eye out. She is also quite young, but who could care? The crowd is pushing her along now, treating you to glimpses of her jumbled torso, her mismatched legs. At the corner, she strains to send one last fond spasm after the godling's shuttle. Then her face reverts to its usual expression of dim pain, and she lurches onto the moving walkway, stumbling into people. The walkway junctions with another. She crosses, trips, and collides with the casualty rail. Finally, she comes out into a little bare place called a park. The sports show is working, a basketball game in 3D is going on right overhead, but all she does is squeeze onto a bench and huddle there while a ghostly free throw goes by her ear. After that, nothing at all happens except a few furtive hand-mouth gestures, which don't even interest her benchmates. But you're curious about the city? So ordinary, after all, in the future? There's plenty to swing with here, and it's not all that far in the future, Dad. But pass up the sci-fi stuff for now, like, for instance, the holovision technology that's put TV and radio in museums, or the worldwide carrier field bouncing down from satellites, controlling communication and transport systems all over the globe. That was a spin-off from asteroid mining. Pass it by. We're watching that girl. I'll give you just one goodie. Maybe you noticed on the sports show or on the streets? No commercials. No ads. That's right. No ads. An eyeballer for you. Look around. Not a billboard, sign, slogan, jingle, skywrite, blurb, sublim flash in this whole fun world. Brand names? Only in those ticky little peep screens in the stores, and you could hardly call that advertising. How does that finger you? Think about it. That girl is still sitting there. She's parked right under the base of the GTX tower, as a matter of fact. Look way up, and you can see the sparkles from the bubble on top, up there among the domes of Godland. Inside that bubble is a boardroom. Near bronze shield on the door, Global Transmissions Corporation. Not that that means anything. I happen to know there are six people in that room. Five of them technically male, and the sixth isn't easily thought of as a mother. They're absolutely unremarkable. Those faces were seen once at the nuptials and will show again in their obituaries and oppress nobody either time. If you're looking for the secret big blue meanies of the world, forget it. I know. Xandu, I know. Flesh, power, glory, you'd horrify them. What they do like up there is to have things orderly, especially their communications. You could say they've dedicated their lives to that, to freeing the world from garble. Their nightmares are about hemorrhages of information, channels screwed up, plans misimplemented, garble creeping in. Their gigantic wealth only worries them. It keeps opening new vistas of disorder. Luxury? They wear what the tailors put on them, eat what their cooks serve them. See that old boy there? His name is Isham. He's sipping water and frowning as he listens to a data ball. The water is prescribed by his metastaff. It tastes awful. The data ball also contains a disquieting message about his son, Paul. But it's time to go back down, far below to our girl. Look! She's toppled over, sprawling on the ground. A tepid commotion ensues among the bystanders. The consensus is she's dead, which she disproves by bubbling a little, and presently she's taken away by one of the superb ambulances of the future, which are a real improvement over ours when one happens to be around. At the local Bellevue, the usual things are done by the usual team of clowns, aided by a saintly mop pusher. Our girl revives enough to answer the questionnaire without which you can't die, even in the future. Finally, she's cast up, a pumped-out hulk on a cot in the long, dim ward. Again, nothing happens for a while, except that her eyes leak a little from the understandable disappointment of finding herself still alive. But somewhere one GTX computer has been tickling another, and toward midnight something does happen. First comes an attendant who pulls screens around her. Then a man in a business doublet comes daintily down the ward. He motions the attendant to strip off the sheet and go. The groggy girl brute heaves up, big hands clutching at body parts you'd pay not to see. Burke? P. Burke, is that your name?
Yes. Croak. Are you policeman?
No. They'll be along shortly, I expect. Public suicide's a felony.
I'm sorry.
He has a quarter in his hand. No family, right?
No.
You're 17. 1 year City College. What did you study?
Languages.
Huh. Say something. An unintelligible rasp. He studies, sir. Seen close, he's not so elegant. Errand boy type. Why did you try to kill yourself? She stares at him with dead rat dignity, hauling up the gray sheet. Give him a point. He doesn't ask twice. Tell me, did you see Breath this afternoon? Dead as she nearly is, that ghastly love look wells up. Breath is the three young gods, a loser's cult. Give the man another point, he interprets her expression. How would you like to meet them? The girl's eyes bug out grotesquely. I have a job for someone like you. It's hard work. If you did well, you'd be meeting Breath and stars like that all the time. Is he insane? She's deciding she really did die. But it means you'd never see anybody you know again. Never, ever, you'd be legally dead. Even the police won't know. Do you want to try? It all has to be repeated while her great jaw slowly sets. Show me the fire I walk through. Finally, P. Burke's prints are in his quarter, the man holding the big, rancid girl body without a sign of distaste. It makes you wonder what else he does. And then, the magic. Sudden, silent trot of litter-bearers tucking P. Burke into something quite different from a Bellevue stretcher. The oiled slide into the daddy of all luxury ambulances. Real flowers in that holder. And the long, jarless rush to nowhere. Nowhere is warm and gleaming and kind with nurses. Where did you hear that money can't buy genuine kindness? And clean clouds folding P. Burke into bewildered sleep. Sleep which merges into feedings and washings and more sleeps into drowsy moments of afternoon where midnight should be, and gentle business-like voices and friendly but very few faces, and endless painless hyposprays and peculiar numbnesses. And later comes the steadying rhythms of days and nights, and a quickening which P. Burke doesn't identify as health, but only knows that the fungus place in her armpit is gone. And then she's up and following those few new faces with growing trust, first tottering, then walking strongly, all better now, climbing down the short hall to the tests, and the other things. And here is our girl looking, if possible, worse than before. You thought this was Cinderella transistorized? The disimprovement in her looks comes from the electrode jacks peeping out of her sparse hair, and there were other meldings of flesh and metal. On the other hand, that collar and spinal plate are really an asset. You won't mind if you miss seeing that neck. P. Burke is ready for training in her new job. The training takes place in her suite and is exactly what you'd call a charm course. How to walk, sit, eat, speak, blow her nose, how to stumble, to urinate, to hiccup deliciously, how to make each nose blow or shrug delightfully, subtly different from any ever swooled before. As the man said, it's hard work. But P. Burke proves apt. Somewhere in that horrible body is a gazelle, a houri, who would have been buried forever without this crazy chance. See the ugly duckling go. Only it isn't precisely P. Burke who's stepping, laughing, shaking out her shining hair. How could it be? P. Burke is doing it all right, but she's doing it through something. Something is to all appearances a live girl. You were warned. This is the future. When they first open the big cryo case and show her new body, she says just one word, staring, gulping. How? Simple, really. Watch P. Burke and her sack and scuff stump down the hall beside Joe, the man who supervises the technical part of her training. Joe doesn't mind P. Burke's looks. He hasn't noticed them. To Joe, system matrices are beautiful. They go into a dim room containing a huge cabinet like a one-man sauna and a console for Joe. The room has a glass wall that's all dark now. And just for your information, the whole shebang is 500 feet underground near what used to be Carbondale, Pennsylvania. Joe opens the sauna cabinet like a big clamshell standing on end with a lot of funny business inside. Our girl shucks her shift and yawks into it bare, totally unembarrassed, eager. She settles in face forward, butting jacks into sockets. Joe closes it carefully onto her humpback. Clunk. She can't see in there or hear or move. She hates this minute, but how she loves what comes next. Joe's at his console, and the lights on the other side of the glass wall come up. A room is on the other side, all fluff and kicky bits, a girly bedroom. In the bed is a small mound of silk with a rope of yellow hair hanging out. The sheet stirs and gets whammed back flat. Sitting up in the bed is the darlingest girl child you've ever seen. She quivers. Porno for angels. She sticks both her little arms straight up, flips her hair, looks around full of sleepy pizzazz. Then she can't resist rubbing her hands down over her mini breasts and belly, because, you see, it's the god-awful P. Burke who is sitting there hugging her perfect girl body, looking at you out of delighted eyes. Then the kitten hops out of bed and crashes flat on the floor. From the sauna in the dim room comes a strangled noise. P. Burke, trying to rub her wired-up elbow, is suddenly smothered in two bodies, electrodes jerking in her flesh. Joe juggles inputs, crooning into his mic. The flurry passes. It's all right. In the lighted room, the elf gets up, casts a cute glare at the glass wall, and goes into a transparent cubicle. A bathroom. What else? She's a live girl, and live girls have to go to the bathroom after a night's sleep, even if their brains are in a sauna cabinet in the next room. And if P. Burke isn't in that cabinet, she's in the bathroom. Perfectly simple if you have the glue for that closed training circuit that's letting her run her neural system by remote control. Now let's get one thing clear. P. Burke does not feel her brain is in the sauna room. She feels she's in that sweet little body. When you wash your hands, do you feel the water is running on your brain? Of course not. You feel the water on your hand, although the feeling is actually a potential pattern flickering over the electrochemical jelly between your ears, and it's delivered there via the long circuits from your hands. Just so, P. Burke's brain in the cabinet feels the water on her hands in the bathroom. The fact that the signals have jumped across space on the way in makes no difference at all. If you want the jargon, it's known as eccentric projection or sensory reference, and you've done it all your life. Clear? Time to leave the honeypot to her toilet training. She's made a boo-boo with a toothbrush because P. Burke can't get used to what she sees in the mirror. But wait, you see, where did that girl body come from? P. Burke asks that too, dragging out the words. They grow him, Joe tells her. He couldn't care less about the flesh department. PDs, placental decanters, modified embryos, see? Fit the control implants in later. Without a remote operator, it's just a vegetable. Look at the feet. No callus at all. He knows because they told him.
Oh. Oh, she's incredible.
Yeah, a neat job. Want to try walking talking mode today? You're coming on fast. And she is. Joe's reports and the reports from the nurse and the doctor and the style men go to a bushy man upstairs who is some kind of medical cyber tech, but mostly a project administrator. His reports in turn go to the GTX boardroom. Certainly not. Did you think this is a big thing? His reports just go up. The point is they're green. Very green. P. Burke promises well. So the bushy man, Dr. Tesla, has procedures to initiate. The little kitten's dossier in the central databank, for instance, purely routine. And the phase-in schedule, which will put her on the scene. This is simple. A small exposure in an off-network holo show. Next, he has to line out the event which will fund and target her. This takes budget meetings, clearances, coordination. The Burke Project begins to recruit and grow. And there's the messy business of the name, which always gives Dr. Tesla an acute pain in the bush. The name comes out weird when it's suddenly discovered that Burke's P stands for Philadelphia. Philadelphia? The astrologer grooves on it. Joe thinks it would help identification. The semantics are references brotherly love, Liberty Bell, Mainline, Low Teratogenesis, blah, blah. Nicknames, Philly, Paula, Pootie, Delphi, is it good, bad? Finally, Delphi is gingerly declared Gudo. Burke is replaced by something nobody remembers. Coming along now, we're at the official checkout down in the underground suite, which is as far as the training circuits reach. The bushy Dr. Tesla is there, braced by two budgetary types and a quiet, fatherly man, whom he handles like hot plasma. Joe swings the door wide, and she steps shyly in. There are little Delphi, 15 and flawless. Tesla introduces her around. She's child solemn, a beautiful baby to whom something so wonderful has happened you can feel the tingles. She doesn't smile, she brims. That brimming joy is all that shows of P. Burke, the forgotten Hulk in the sauna next door. But P. Burke doesn't know that she's alive. It's Delphi who lives every warm inch of her. One of the budget type lets go a libidinous snuffle and freezes. The fatherly man, whose name is Mr. Cantle, clears his throat. Well, young lady, are you ready to go to work?
Yes, sir, gravely from the elf.
We'll see. Has anybody told you what you're going to do for us?
No, sir.
Joe and Tesla exhale quietly. Good. He eyes her, probing for the blind brain in the room next door. Do you know what advertising is? He's talking dirty, hitting to shock. Delphi's eyes widen, her little chin goes up. Joe is in ecstasy at the complex expressions P. Burke is getting through. Mr. Cantle waits.
It's when they used to tell people to buy things.
She swallows.
It's not allowed.
That's right. Mr. Cantle leans back, grave. advertising as it used to be is against the law. A display other than the legitimate use of the product intended to promote its sale. In former times, every manufacturer was free to tout his wares any way, place, or time he could afford. All the media and most of the landscape was taken up with extravagant competing displays. The thing became uneconomic. The public rebelled. Since the so-called Huckster Act, sellers have been restrained to, I quote, displays in or on the product itself visible during its legitimate use or in on-premises sales. Mr. Cantle leans forward. Now tell me, Delphi, why do people buy one product rather than another? Well, enchanting puzzlement from Delphi. They see them and like them, or they hear about them from somebody? Touch of P. Burke there. She didn't say from a friend. Partly. Why did you buy your particular body lift?
I never had a body lift, sir.
Mr. Cantle frowns. What gutters did they drag for these remotes?
Well, what brand of water do you drink?
Just what was in the faucet, sir, says Delphi, humbly. I did try to boil it.
Good God, he scowls.
Tesla stiffens.
Well, what did you boil it in, a cooker?
The shining yellow head nods.
What brand of cooker did you buy?
I didn't buy it, sir, says frightened P. Burke through Delphi's lips. But I know the best kind. A Ranga has a burned body. I saw the name when she...
Exactly.
Cantle's fatherly beam comes back strong. The burned body account is a strong one, too. You saw a Nanga using one, so you thought it must be good, eh? And it is good. Or a great human being like a Nanga wouldn't be using it. Absolutely right. And now, Delphi, you know what you're going to be doing for us. You're going to show some products. Doesn't sound very hard, does it?
Oh, no, sir.
Baffled child stare. Joe gloats.
And you must never, never tell anyone what you're doing.
Cantle's eyes bore for the brain behind the seductive child. You're wondering why we ask you to do this naturally. There's a very serious reason. All those products people use, food and health aids and cookers and cleaners and clothes and cars, they're all made by people. Somebody put in years of hard work designing and making them. A man comes up with a fine new idea for a better product. He has to get a factory and machinery and hire workmen. Now, what happens if people have no way about hearing about his product? Word of mouth is far too slow and unreliable. Nobody might ever stumble upon his new product or find out how good it was, right? And then he and all the people who work for him, they'd go bankrupt, right? So, Delphi, there has to be some way that large numbers of people can get a look at a good new product, right? How? By letting people see you using it. You're giving that man a chance. Delphi's little head is nodding in happy relief.
Yes, sir. Oh, I do see now, but sir, it seems so sensible. Why don't they let you?
Cantle smiles sadly. It's an overreaction, my dear. History goes by swings. People overreact and pass harsh, unrealistic laws which attempt to stamp out an essential social process. When this happens, the people who understand have to carry on as best they can until the pendulum swings back. He sighs. The Huckster laws are bad, inhuman laws, Delphi, despite their good intent. If they were strictly observed, they would wreak havoc. Our economy, our society, would be cruelly destroyed. We'd be back in the caves. His inner fire is showing. If the Huckster laws were strictly enforced, he'd be back punching a data bank. It's our duty, Delphi, our solemn social duty. We are not breaking the law. You will be using the product. But people wouldn't understand if they knew. They would become upset just as you did. So you must be very, very careful not to mention any of this to anybody. And somebody will be very, very carefully monitoring Delphi's speech circuits. Now we're all straight, aren't we, little Delphi here? He is speaking to the invisible creature next door. Little Delphi is going to live a wonderful, exciting life. She's going to be a girl people watch, and she's going to be using fine products people will be glad to know about and helping the good people who make them. Yours will be a genuine social contribution. He keys up his pitch. The creature in there must be older. Delphi digests this with ravishing gravity.
But, sir, how do I? don't worry about a thing. You'll have people behind you whose job it is to select the most worthy products for you to use. Your job is just to do as they say. They'll show you what outfits to wear to parties, what sun cars and viewers to buy, and so on. That's all you have to do. Parties, clothes, sun cars, Delphi's pink mouth opens, and P. Burke's starved 17-year-old head, the ethics of product sponsorship float far away. Now tell me in your own words what your job is, Delphi. Yes, sir, I'm to go to parties and buy things and use them as they tell me to help the people who work in factories. And what did I say was so important? Oh, I shouldn't let anybody know about the things. Right. Mr. Cantle has another paragraph he uses when the subject shows, well, immaturity. But he can sense only eagerness here. Good. He doesn't really enjoy the other speech. It is a lucky girl who can have all the fun she wants while doing good for others, isn't it? He beams around. There's a prompt shuffling of chairs. Clearly, this one is go. Joe leads her out, grinning. The poor fool thinks they're admiring her coordination. It's out into the world for Delphi now, and at this point the up channels get used. On the administrative side, account schedules are open, subproducts are activated. On the technical side, the reserve bandwidth is cleared. That carrier field, remember? A new name is welting for Delphi, a name she'll never hear. It's a long string of binaries which have been quietly cycling in a GTX tank ever since a certain beautiful person didn't wake up. The name winks out of cycle, dances from pulses into modulations of modulations, whizzes through phasing, and shoots into a gigaband beam racing up to a synchronous satellite poised over Guatemala. From there, the beam pours 20,000 miles back to Earth again, forming an all-pervasive field of structured energetics, supplying tuned demand points all over the Can-Am quadrant. With that field, if you have the right credit rating, you can sit at a GTX console and operate an ore extractor in Brazil. Or, if you have some simple credentials, like, you know, being able to walk on water, you could shoot a spool into the network holocam shows running day and night in every home and dorm and rec site. Or you could create a continent-wide traffic jam. Is it any wonder GTX guards those inputs like his sacred trucks? Delphi's name appears as a tiny, analyzable non-redundancy in the flux, and she'd be very proud if she knew about it. It would strike P. Burke as magic. P. Burke never even understood robot cars, but Delphi is in no sense a robot. Call her a Waldo if you must. The fact is, she's just a girl. A real-life girl with her brain in an unusual place. A simple real-time online system with plenty of bitrate, even as you and you. The point of all this hardware, which isn't very much hardware in this society, is so Delphi can walk out of that underground suite a mobile demand point, draining an omnipresent field form, and she does. 89 pounds of tender girl flesh and blood with a few metallic components, stepping out into the sunlight to be taken to her new life. A girl with everything going for, including a Meditech escort. Walking lovely, stopping to widen her eyes at the big antennae system overhead. The mere fact that something called P. Burke is left behind down underground has no bearing at all. P. Burke is totally unself-aware and happy as a clam in a shell. Her bed has been moved into the Waldo cabinet room now, and P. Burke isn't in the cabinet. P. Burke is climbing out of an air van in a fabulous Colorado beef preserve, and her name is Delphi. Delphi is looking at live charolite steers and live cottonwoods and aspens gold against the blue smog and stepping over live grass to be welcomed by the reserve super's wife. The super's wife is looking forward to a visit from Delphi and her friends, and by a happy coincidence, there's a holocam outfit out here doing a piece for the Nature Nuts. You could write the script for yourself now while Delphi learns a few rules about structural interferences and how to handle the tiny time lag which results from the new 40,000-mile parenthesis in her nervous system. That's right. The people with the least holocam rig naturally find the gold aspen shadows look a lot better on Delphi's flank than they do on a steer. And Delphi's face improves the mountains, too, when you can see them. But the nature freaks aren't quite as joyful as you'd expect. See you in Barcelona, kitten, the headman says sourly as they pack up. Barcelona? Echoes Delphi with that charming little subliminal lag. She sees where his hand is and steps back. Cool, it's not her fault, another man says wearily. He knocks back his grizzled hair. Maybe they'll leave in some of the gut.
Delphi watches them go off to load the spools onto the GTX transport for processing. Her hand moves over the breast the man had touched. Back under Carbondale, P. Burke has discovered something new about her Delphi body, about the difference between Delphi and her own grim carcass. She's always known Delphi has almost no sense of taste or smell. They explained about that. Only so much bandwidth. You don't have to taste a sun car, do you? And the slight overall dimness of Delphi's sense of touch? She's familiar with that, too. Fabrics that would prickle P. Burke's own hide feel like a cool plastic film to Delphi. But the blank spots, it took her a while to notice them. Delphi doesn't have much privacy. Investments of her size don't. So she's slow about discovering there's certain definite places where her beastly P. Burke body feels things that Delphi's dainty flesh does not. Channel space again, she thinks, and forgets it in the pure bliss of being Delphi. You ask how a girl could forget a thing like that. Look, P. Burke is about as far as you could get from the concept girl. She's a female, yes, but for her, sex is a four-letter word spelled P-A-I-N. She isn't quite a virgin. You don't want the detail. She'd been about 12 and the freak lovers were bomb blind. When they came down, they threw her out with a small hole in her anatomy and a mortal one elsewhere. She dragged off by her first and last shot, and she can still hear the clerk's incredulous guffaws. Do you see why Delphi grins, stretching her delicious little numb body in the sun? She faintly feels, beams, saying, "Please, I'm ready now." Ready for what? For Barcelona, like the sour man said, where this nature thing is now making it strong in the amateur section of the festival? A winner! Like he also said, a lot of strip mines and dead fish have been scrubbed, but who cares with Delphi's darling face so visible? So it's time for Delphi's face and her other delectabilities to show on Barcelona's Playa Nueva, which means switching her channel to the RAF Syncast. They ship her at night to the nanosecond transfer, and it isn't even noticed that it's insignificant part of Delphi that lives 500 feet under Carbondale, so excited that the nurse has to make sure she eats. The circuit switches while Delphi sleeps, that is, while P. Burke is out of the Waldo cabinet. The next time she plugs in is to open Delphi's eyes, and it's no different. Do you notice which relay boards your phone calls go through? And now for the event that turns the sugar cube from Colorado into the princess. Literally true. He's a prince, or rather an infante of an old Spanish line that got shined up in the neo-monarchy. He's also 81 with a passion for birds, the kind you see in zoos. Now, it suddenly turns out that he isn't poor at all. Quite the reverse. His old sister laughs in their tax lawyer's face and starts restoring the family hacienda while the infante totters out to court Delphi. And little Delphi begins to live the life of the gods. What do gods do? Well, everything beautiful. But remember, Mr. Cantle? The main point is things. Ever see a god empty-handed? You can't be a god without at least a magic girdle or an eight-legged horse. But in the old days, some stone tablets or winged sandals or a chariot drawn by virgins would do a god for life. No more. Gods make it on novelty now. By Delphi's time, the hunt for new god gear is turning the earth and seas inside out and sending frantic fingers to the stars. And what gods have, mortals desire. So Delphi starts on a Euromarket shopping spree, squired by her old infante, thereby doing her bit to stave off social collapse. Social what? Didn't you get it? When Mr. Castle talked about a world where advertising is banned and 15 million consumers are glued to their holocam shows? One capricious self-powered god can wreck you. Take the nose filter massacre. Years the industry sweated, years to achieve an almost invisible enzymatic filter. So one day a couple of pop gods show up wearing nose filters like big purple bats. By the end of the week, the world market is screaming for purple bats. Then it switched to bird heads and skulls, but by the time the industry retooled, the crazies had dropped bird heads and gone to injection gloves. Ah, blood. Multiply that by a million consumer industries and you can see why it's economic to have a few controllable gods, especially with the beautiful hunk of space R&D the Peace Department laid out for, in which the taxpayers are only too glad to have taken off their hands by an outfit like GTX, which everybody knows is almost a public trust. And so you, or rather GTX, find a creature like P. Burke and give her Delphi. And Delphi helps keep things orderly. She does what you tell her to. Why? That's right, Mr. Cantle never finished his speech. But here come the Tess of Delphi's button nose twinkling in the torrent of news and entertainment. And she's noticed. The feedback shows a flock of viewers turning up the amps when this country baby gets tangled in our new colloidal body jewels. She registers at a couple of major scenes, too, and when the Infante gives her a sun car, little Delphi trying out sun cars, he's a tiger. There's a solid response in high credit country. Mr. Candle is humming his happy tune as he cancels the Benelux subnet option to guest her on a new cook show called Walk Venus. And now, for the super posh old world wedding. The hacienda has Moorish baths and 6-foot silver candelabra and real black horses, and the Spanish Vatican blesses them. The final event is a grand gaucho ball with the old prince and his little infanta on a bowered balcony. She is a spectacular doll of silver lace, wildly launching toy doves at her new friends whirling by below. The Infanta beams. He switches his old nose to the scent of her sweet excitement. His doctor has been very helpful. Surely now, after he's been so patient with the sun cars and all the nonsense. The child looks up at him, saying something incomprehensible about breath. He makes out that she's complaining about the 3 singers she had begged for. They've changed, she marvels. Haven't they changed? They're so dreary. I'm so happy now. And Delphi falls fainting against a Gothic Vergueno. Her American duenna rushes up and calls help. Delphi's eyes are open, but Delphi isn't there. The duenna pokes among Delphi's hair and slaps her. The old prince grimaces. He has no idea what she is beyond an excellent solution to his tax problems, but he had been a falconer in his youth. There comes to his mind the small pinion birds which were flung up to stimulate the hawks. He pockets the veined claw to which he had promised certain indulgences, and departs to design his new aviary. This is WBAI, New York. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Anne-Marie Henriksen. It is 1 a.m. And I will return to the story I'm reading, which is The Girl Who Was Plugged In by James Tiptree Jr. Delphi also departs with her retinue to the Infante's newly discovered yacht. The trouble isn't serious. It's only that 5,000 miles away and 500 feet down, P. Burke has been doing it too well. They've always known she has terrific aptitude. Joe says he never saw a remote takeover so fast. No disorientations, no rejections. The psychomed talks about self-alienation. She's going into Delphi like a salmon to the sea. She isn't eating or sleeping. They can't keep her out of the body cabinet or get her blood moving. There are necroses under her grisly sit-down. Crisis! So Delphi gets a long sleep on the yacht, and P. Burke gets it pounded through her perforated head that she's endangering Delphi. Nurse Fleming thinks of that, thus alienated in the psychomed. They rig a pool down there, Nurse Fleming again, and chase P. Burke back and forth, and she loves it. So naturally, when they plug her in again, Delphi loves it too. Every noon beside the yacht's hydrofoils, darling Delphi clips along in the blue sea they've warned her not to drink. And every night around the shoulder of the world, an ill-shaped thing in a dark burrow beats its way across a sterile pool. So presently, the yacht stands up on its foils and carries Delphi to the program Mr. Candle has waiting. It's long range. She's scheduled for at least 2 decades product life. Phase 1 calls for her to connect with a flock of young ultra-riches who are romping loose between Brioni and Jakarta, where a competitor named PEV could pick them off. A routine luxgear opsy. No politics, no policy angles, and the main budget items are the title and the yacht, which was idle anyway. The storyline is that Delphi goes to accept some rare birds for her prince. Who cares? The point is that the Haiti area is no longer radioactive, and look, the gods are there. And so are several new Carib West Happy Isles, which can afford GTX rates. In fact, 2 of them are GTX subsids. But you don't want to get the idea that all these newsworthy people are wired up Robbies for pity's sake. You don't need many if they're placed right. Delphi asked Joe about that when he comes down to Barranquilla to check her over. P. Burke's own mouth hasn't said much for a while. Are there many like me? Nobody's like you, Buttons. Look, are you still getting Van Allen Warble? I mean, like Davy. Is he a remote? Davy is the lad who is helping her collect the birds. A sincere redhead who needs a little more exposure. Davy? He's one of Matt's boys. Some psycho job. They haven't any channel. What about the real ones? Juna Van O or Ali or Jim Ten? Juno was born with a pile of GTX Basic where her brain should be, and she's nothing but a pain. Jimmy does what his astrologer tells him. Look, Peanut, where do you get the idea that you aren't real? You are the realest. Aren't you having joy? Oh, Joe, flinging her little arms around him in his analyzer grids. Oh, me gusta mucho muchísimo. Hey, he pets her yellow head, folding the analyzer. 3,000 miles north and 500 feet down, a forgotten hulk in a body Waldo glows. And is she having joy? To waken out of the nightmare of being P. Burke and find herself a Perry, a star girl, on a yacht in paradise with no more to do than adorn herself and play with toys and attend revels and greet her friends? Her? P. Burke having friends and turn the right way for the holocams? Joy. And it shows. One look at Delphi and the viewers know. Dreams can come true. Look at her riding Pillion on Davy's sea bike, carrying an apoplectic macaw in a silver hoop. Oh, Morton, let's go there this winter. Or learning the Japanese Shinshona from the Kobe group in a dress that looks like a blowtorch rising from one knee and which should sell big in Texas. Morton, is that real fire? Happy, happy little girl. And Davy, he's her pet and her baby, and she loves to help him fix his red gold hair. P. Burke marveling, running Delphi's fingers through the curls. Of course Davy is one of Matt's boys. Not impotent exactly, but very, very low drive. Nobody knows exactly what Matt does with his bitty budget, but the boys are useful and one or two have made names. He's perfect for Delphi. In fact, the psychomed lets her take him to bed, two kittens in a basket. Davy doesn't mind the fact that Delphi sleeps like the dead. That's when P. Burke is out of the body Waldo up at Carbondale attending to her own depressing needs. Funny thing about that. Most of her sleepy time, Delphi is just a gently ticking, lush little vegetable waiting for P-Burke to get back on the controls. But now and again, Delphi all by herself smiles a bit or stirs in her sleep. Once she breathed a sound, yes. Under Carbondale, P-Burke knows nothing. She's asleep too, dreaming of Delphi. What else? But if the bushy Dr. Tesla had heard that single syllable, his bush would have turned snow white because Delphi is turned off. He doesn't. Davy is too dim to notice, and Delphi's staff boss wasn't monitoring. And they've all got something else to think about now, because the cold fire dress sells 500,000 copies, and not only in Texas. The GTX computers already know it. When they correlate a minor demand for macaws in Alaska, the problem comes to human attention. Delphi is something special. It's a problem, see, because Delphi is targeted on a limited consumer bracket. Now it turns out that she has mass spot potential. Those macaws in Fairbanks, man, it's like trying to shoot mice with an ABM. A whole new ball game. Dr. Tesla and the fatherly Mr. Candle start going around in headquarters circles and buddy lunching together when they can get away from a seventh-level weasel boy who scares them both. In the end, it's decided to ship Delphi down to the GTX Holocam Enclave in Chile to try a spot on one of the mainstream shows. Never mind why an Infanta takes up acting. The Holocam complex occupies a couple of mountains where an observatory once used the clean air. Holocam total environment shells are very expensive and electronically super stable. Inside them, actors can move freely without going off register, and the whole scene or any selected part will show up on the viewer's home in complete 3D. 3 so real you can look up their noses and much denser than you get from mobile rigs. You can blow a breast 10 feet tall when there's no molecular skiffle around. The Enclave looks, well, take everything you know about Hollywood Burbank and throw it away. What Delphi sees coming down is a neat giant mushroom farm, domes of all sizes up to monsters for the big games and stuff. It's orderly sizes up to monsters. It's orderly. The idea that art thrives on creative flamboyance has long been torpedoed by proof that what art needs is computers, because this showbiz has something that TV and Hollywood never had. Automated, inbuilt, viewer feedback. Samples, ratings, critics, polls, forget it. With that carrier field, you can get real-time response sensor readouts from every receiver in the world, served up at your console. That started as a thingy to give the public more influence on the content. Yes. Try it, man. You're at the console. Slice to the sex, age, education, ethno, etc. Education audience of your choice and your start. You can't miss. Where the feedback warms up, give them more of that. Warm, warmer, hot, you've hit it. The secret itch under those hides, the dream in those hearts. You don't need to know the name. With your hand controlling all the input and your eye reading all the response, you can make them a god, and somebody will do the same for you. But Delphi just sees rainbows when she gets to the degaussing ports in the field relay and takes her first look at the insides of those shells. The next thing she sees is a team of shapers and technicians descending on her and millisecond timers everywhere. The tropical leisure is finished. She's in Gigawook Mainstream now with the funnel maw of the unceasing hose that's pumping the sight and sound and flesh and blood and sobs and laugh and dreams of reality into the world's happy head. Little Delphi is going plonk into a zillion homes in prime time and nothing is left to chance. Work! And again, Delphi proves out. Of course, it's really P. Burke down under Carbondale who's doing it, but who remembers that carcass? Certainly not P. Burke. She hasn't spoken through her own mouth for months. Delphi doesn't even recall dreaming of her when she wakes up. And as for the show itself, don't bother. It's gone on so long no living soul could unscramble the plot line. Delphi's trial spot has something to do with a widow and her dead husband's brother's amnesia. The flap comes over after Delphi's spots begin to flash out along the world hose, and the feedback appears. You've guessed it, of course. Sensational. As you'd say, they identify. The report actually says something like, inks an amp with an A string of percentages, meaning that Delphi not only has it for anybody with a Y chromosome, but also for women and everything in between. It's the sweet, supernatural jackpot, the million to one. Remember your Harlow, a sexpot, sure. But why did bitter housefrows and Gary in Memphis know that the vanilla ice cream goddess with the white hair and the crazy eyebrows was their baby girl and write loving letters to Jean warning her that their husbands weren't good enough for her? Why? The GTX analysts don't know that either, but they know what to do with it when it happens. Back in his bird sanctuary, the old Infante spots it without benefit of computers and gazes thoughtfully at his bride and widow's weeds. It might, he feels, be well to accelerate the completion of his studies. The excitement reaches down to the burrow under Carbondale while P. Burke gets two medical exams in a week, and a chronically inflamed electrode is in place. Nurse Fleming also gets an assistant who doesn't do much nursing, but is very interested in access doors and identity tabs. And in Chile, little Delphi is promoted to a new home up among the stars residential spreads and a private jitney to carry her to work. For Hopkins, there's a new computer terminal and a full-time schedule man. What is the schedule crowded with? Things. And here begins the trouble. You probably saw that coming, too. What does she think? She is a goddamn consumer rep? Mr. Candle's fatherly face in Carbondale contorts. The girl's upset, Miss Fleming says stubbornly. She believes that, what you told her about helping people and good new products. They are good products, Mr. Candle snaps automatically, but his anger is under control. He hasn't got to where he is by irrelevant reactions. She says the plastic gave her a rash and the glow pills made her dizzy. Well, good God, she shouldn't swallow them, Dr. Fassel puts in agitatedly. You told her she'd use them, persists Miss Fleming. Mr. Candle is busy figuring out how to ease this problem to the feral-faced young man. What, was it a goose that lays the golden eggs? Whatever he says to Level 7 down in Chile, the offending products vanish, and a symbol goes into Delphi's tank matrix, one that means roughly, balance unit resistance against PR index. This means that Delphi's complaints will be endured as long as her pot response stays above a certain level. What happens when it sinks need not concern us here. And to compensate, the price of her exposure time rises again. She's a regular on the show now, and her response is still climbing. See her under the sizzling lasers in a holocom shell set up as a walkway accident. The show is guessing an acupuncture school shell. I don't think this new body lift is safe, Delphi is saying. It's made a funny blue spot on me. Look, Mr. Veer. She wiggles to show where the mini gray pack that imparts a delicious sense of weightlessness is attached. So don't leave it on, Dee, with your... Watch that deck spot, it's starting to swing. But if I don't wear it, it isn't honest. They should insulate it more or something, don't you see? The show's beloved old father, who is the casualty, gives a sentinel snigger. I'll tell him, Mr. Vera mutters. Look now, as you step back, Ben, like this, so it just shows, see? And just hold two beats. Obediently, Delphi turns, and through the dazzle, her eyes connect with a pair of strange, dark ones. She squints. A quite young man is lounging alone by the port, apparently waiting to use the chamber. Delphi is used by now to young men looking at her with many peculiar expressions, but she isn't used to what she gets here. A jolt of something somber and knowing. Secrets. Eyes, Dee! Eyes! She moves through the routine, stealing peeks at the stranger. He stares back. He knows something. When they let her go, she comes shyly to him. Living wild, kitten. Cool voice, hot underneath. What do you mean? Dumping on the product. You trying to get dead? But it isn't right, she tells him. They don't know, but I do. I've been wearing it. His cool is jolted. You're out of your head. Oh, they'll see I'm right when they check it, she explains. They're just so busy when I tell them. He's staring down at the little flower face. His mouth opens, closes. What are you doing in the sewer anyway? Who are you? Bewilderedly, she says, I'm Delphi. Holy Zen. What's wrong? Who are you, please? Her people are moving her out, no nodding at him. Sorry you ran over, Mr. The scrim girl says. He mutters something, but it's lost as her convoy bustles her toward the flower deck jitney. Hear the click of an invisible ignition train being armed? Who was he? Delphi asks her hair man. The hair man is bending up and down from his knees as he works. Paul Isham III, he says, and puts a comb in his mouth. Who's that? I can't see. He mumbles around the comb, meaning, are you jiving? Because he has to be in the middle of the GTX enclave. Next day, there's a darkly smoldering face under a turban towel when Delphi and the shell's paraplegic go to use the carbonated pool. She looks. He looks. And the next day, too. Hear the automatic sequencer cutting in? The system couples, the fuel begins to travel. Poor old Isham Sr. You have to feel sorry for a man who values order. When he begets young, genetic information is still transmitted in the old ape way. 1 minute it's a happy midget with a rubber duck. Look around and here is this huge, healthy stranger, opaquely emotional, running with God knows who. Questions are heard where there's nothing to question and eruptions claimed moral outrage. When this is called to Papa's attention, it may take time in that boardroom, Papa does what he can, but without immortality juice, the problem is worrisome. And young Paul Isham is a bear. He's bright and articulate and tender-souled and incessantly active, and he and his friends are choking with appalment at the world their father's made. And it hasn't taken Paul long to discover that his father's houses, many mansions, and even the GTX computers can't relate everything to everything else. He notices that a decaying project with adds up to something like sponsoring marginal creativity, the freelance team that discovered Delphi was one such grantee. And from there it turns out that an agile lad named Isham can get his hands on a viable patch of GTX holocam facilities. So here he is with his little band way down the mushroom farm mountain, busily spooling a show which has no relationship to Delphi's. It's built on bizarre techniques and unsettling distortions pregnant with social protest, an underground expression to you. All this isn't unknown to his father, of course, but so far it has done nothing more than deepen Isham Sr.'s apprehensive frown, until Paul connects with Delphi. And by the time Papa learns this, those invisible hypergolics have exploded. The energy shells are rushing out. For Paul, you see, is the genuine article. He's serious. He dreams. He even reads, for example, Green Mansions. And he wept fiercely when those fiends burned Rima alive. When he hears that some new GTX pussy is making it big, he sneers and forgets it. He's busy. He never connects the name with this little girl making her idiotic doom protest in the holocam chamber. This strangely simple little girl. And she comes and looks up at him, and he sees Rima, lost Rima, the enchanted bird girl, and his unwired human heart goes twang. And Rima turns out to be Delphi. Do you need a map? The angry puzzlement, the rejection of the dissonance Rima hustling for GTX my father garbage. Cannot be. The loitering around the pool to confirm the swindle. Dark eyes hitting on the blue wonder. Jerky words exchanged in a peculiar stillness. The dreadful reorganization of the image into Rima. Delphi in my father's tentacles. You don't need a map. Not for Delphi either, the girl who loved her gods. She's seen their divine flesh close now, heard their unamplified voices call her name. She's played their god games, worn their garlands. She's even become a goddess herself, although she doesn't believe it. She's not disenchanted, don't think that. She's still full of love. It's just that some crazy kind of hope hasn't, you know, really, you know, you can skip all this when the loving little girl on the yellow brick road meets a man, a real human male, burning with angry compassion and grandly concerned with human justice, who reaches her for her with real male arms, and boom, she loves him back with all her heart. A happy trip, see? Except that it's really P. Burke, 5,000 miles away, who loves Paul. P. Burke, the monster down in a dungeon, smelling of electrode paste, a caricature of a woman burning, melting, obsessed with true love, trying over 20 double thousand miles of hard vacuum to reach her beloved through girl flesh numbed by an invisible film. feeling his arms around the body he thinks is hers, fighting through shadows to give herself to him, trying to taste and smell him through beautiful dead nostrils, to love him back with a body that goes dead in the heart of the fire. Perhaps you get P. Burke's state of mind? She has phases. The trying first, and the shame, the shame. I am not what thou lovest. And the fiercer trying, and the realization that there is no way, never, a bit delayed, isn't it, her understanding that the bargain she made was forever? P. Burke should have noticed those stories about mortals who end up as grasshoppers. You see the outcome, the funneling of all this agony into one dumb protoplasmic drive to fuse with Delphi, to leave, to close out the beast she is chained to become Delphi. Of course it's impossible. However, her torments have an effect on Paul. Delphi as Rima is a potent enough love object, and liberating Delphi's mind requires hours of deeply satisfying instruction in the rottenness of it all. Add in Delphi's body worshipping his flesh, burning in the fire of P. Burke's savage heart. Do you wonder Paul is involved? That's not all. By now they're spending every spare moment together, and some that aren't so spare. Mr. Isham, would you mind staying out of the sports sequence? The script calls for Davy here. Davy's still around. The exposure did him good. What's the difference? Paul yawns. It's just an ad, and I'm not blocking that thing. Shocked silence at this two-letter word. The script girl swallows bravely. I'm sorry, sir. Our directive is to do the social sequence exactly as scripted. We're having to re-pool the sequences we did last week, and Mr. Hopkins is very angry with me. Who the hell is Hopkins, and where is he? Oh, please, Paul, please. Paul unwraps himself, saunters back. The Holocam crew nervously check their angles. The GTX boardroom has a foible about having things pointed at them in theirs. Cold shivers when the image of an Isham nearly went onto the world beam beside the Dial dinner. Worse yet, Paul has no respect for the sacred schedules, which are now a full-time job for Ferret Boy up at headquarters. Paul keeps forgetting to bring her back on time, and poor Hopkins can't cope. So pretty soon the boardroom data ball has an urgent personal action tab for Mr. Isham Sr. They do it the gentle way at first. I can't today, Paul. Why not? They say I have to. It's very important. He strokes the faint gold down on her narrow back. Under Carbondale, Pennsylvania, a blind mole woman shivers. Important. Their importance. Making more gold. Can't you see? To them, you're just a thing to get scratched with. A huckster. Are you going to let them screw you, Dee? Are you? Oh, Paul. He doesn't know it, but he's seeing a weirdie. Remotes aren't hooked up to flow tears. Just say no, Dee. No. Integrity. You have to. But they say it's my job. Will you believe that I can take care of you, Dee? Baby, baby, you're letting them rip us. You have to choose. Tell them no. Paul, I will. And so she does. Brave little Delphi. Insane, P. Burke. Saying, no, please, I promised, Paul. They try some more, still, gently. Paul, Mr. Hopkins told me the reason they don't want us to be together so much is because of who you are, because of your father. She thinks his father is like Mr. Cantle, maybe. Oh, great, Hopkins, I'll fix him. Listen, I can't think about Hopkins now. Ken came back today, he found out something. They're lying on the high Andes metal, watching his friends dive their singing kites. Would you believe on the coast the police have electrodes in their heads? She stiffens in his arms. Ah, oh, yeah, weird. I thought they only used pee-pee on criminals in the army. Don't you see, Dee, something has to be going on. Some movement. Somebody's organizing. How can we find out? He pounds the ground behind her. We should make contact if only we could find out. The news? She asks distractedly. The news. He laughs. There's nothing in the news except what they want people to know. Half the country could burn up and nobody would know it if they didn't want. Oh, Dee, can't you take what I'm explaining to you? They got the whole world programmed. Total control of communication. They've got everybody's minds wired in to think what they show them and want what they give them and give them what they're programmed to want. You can't break out of it. You can't get hold of it anywhere. I don't think they even have a plan except to keep things going round and round, and God knows what's happening to the people or the earth or the other planets. Or maybe one great big vortex of lies and garbage pouring around and around them, getting bigger and bigger. Nothing can ever change. If people don't wake up soon, we're through. He pounds her stomach softly. You have to break out, Dee. I'll try, Paul. I will.
You're mine. They can't have you.
And he goes to see Hopkins, who is indeed cowed. But that night up under Carbondale, the fatherly Mr. Cantle goes in to see P. Burke. P. Burke. And caught in a utility robe like a dead camel in a tent, she cannot at first comprehend that he is telling her to break it off with Paul. P. Burke has never seen Paul. Delphi sees Paul. The fact is, P. Burke can no longer clearly recall that she exists apart from Delphi. Mr. Cantle can scarcely believe it either, but he tries. He points out the futility, the potential embarrassment for Paul. That gets a dim stare from the bulk on the bed. Then he goes into her duty to GTX, her job, isn't she grateful for the opportunity, etc. He's very persuasive. The cobwebby mouth of P. Burke opens and croaks. No. Nothing more seems to be forthcoming. Mr. Cantle isn't dense. He knows an immovable obstacle when he bumps one. He also knows an irresistible force, GTX. The simple solution is to lock the Waldo cabinet until Paul gets tired of waiting for Delphi to wake up. But the cost, the schedules, and there's something odd here. He eyes the corporate asset hulking on the bed and his hunch sense prickles. You see, remotes don't love. They don't have real sex. The circuit's designed that out from the start, so it's been assumed that it's Paul who is diverting himself on something with a pretty little body in Chile. P. Burke can only be doing what comes natural to any ambitious gutter meat. It hasn't occurred to anyone that they're dealing with the real hairy thing whose shadow is blasting out of every hollow show on Earth. Love? Mr. Cantle frowns. The idea is grotesque. But his instinct for the fuzzy line is strong. He will recommend flexibility. And so, in Chile. Darling, I don't have to work tonight and Friday, too. Isn't that right, Mr. Hopkins? Oh, great. When does she come up for parole? Mr. Isham, please be reasonable. Our schedule. Surely your own production people must be needing you. This happens to be true. Paul goes away. Hopkins stares after him, wondering distastefully why an Isham wants to ball a Waldo. How sound are those boardroom belly fears Garble creeps in? It never occurs to Hopkins that an Isham might not know what Delphi is, especially with Davy crying because Paul has kicked him out of Delphi's bed. Delphi's bed is under a real window. Stars, Paul says sleepily. He rolls over, pulling Delphi on top. Are you aware that this is one of the last places on Earth where people can see the stars? Tibet, too, maybe. Paul? Go to sleep. I want to see you sleep. Paul, I sleep so hard. I mean, it's a joke how hard I am to wake up. Do you mind? Yes. But finally, fearfully, she must let go. So that 5,000 miles north, a crazy spent creature can crawl out to gulp concentrates and fall on her cot, but not for long. It's pink dawn when Delphi's eyes open to find Paul's arms around her, his voice saying rude, tender things. He's been kept awake. The nerveless little statue that was her Delphi body nuzzled him in the night. Insane hope rises his fed a couple of nights later when he tells her she called his name in her sleep. And that day Paul's arms kept her from work and Hopkins wails go up to headquarters where the weasel-faced lad is working his sharp tailbone off packing Delphi's program. Mr. Cantle defuses that one. But next week it happens again to a major client, and Ferret Face has connections on the technical side. Now you can see that when you have a field of complexly heterodyne energy modulations tuned to a demand point like Delphi, there are many problems of standweights and lashback and skiffle of all sorts which are normally balanced out with ease by the technology of the future. By the same token, they can be delicately unbalanced too, in ways that feed back until the Waldo operator reacts with striking results. Darling, what the hell? What's wrong? Delphi! Helpless shrieks, writhings. Then the Rima bird is lying wet and limp in his arms, her eyes enormous. I wasn't supposed to, she gasps faintly. They told me not to. Oh, my God, Delphi! And his hard fingers are digging into her thick yellow hair, electronically knowledgeable fingers, and they freeze. You're a doll! You're one of those peepee implants. They control you. I should have known. Oh, God, I should have known. No, Paul, she's sobbing. No, no, no. Damn them. Damn them, what they've done. You're not you. He's shaking her, crouching over her in the bed and jerking her back and forth, glaring at the pitiful beauty. No, she pleads. It's not true, that dark, bad dream back there. I'm Delphi. My father,
filth! Pigs, down them, down them, down them! No, no, she babbles, they were good to me, P. Burke, underground mouthing. They were good to me. Good to me. Another agony skewers her. Up north, the sharp young man wants to make sure this so tiny interference works. Paul can scarcely hang on to her. He's crying, too. I'll kill them. His Delphi a wired-up slave? Spikes in her brain, electronic shackles in his bird's heart? Remember when those savages burned Rima alive? I'll kill the man that's doing this to you. He's still saying it afterwards, but she doesn't hear. She's sure he hates her now. All she wants to do is die. When she finally understands that the fierceness is tenderness, she thinks it's a miracle. He knows. And he still loves. How can she guess that he still got it a little bit wrong? You can't blame Paul. Give him credit that he's even heard about pleasure pain implants and snoops, which by their nature aren't mentioned much by those who know them most intimately. That's what he thinks are being used on Delphi, something to control her. And to listen, he burns at the unknown ears in their bed. Of Waldo bodies and objects like P. Burke, he has heard nothing. So it never crosses his mind as he looks down at his violated bird, so sick with fury and love that he isn't holding all of her. Do you need to be told at the mad resolve gelling in him now? To free Delphi. How? Well, he is, after all, Paul Isham III. And he even has an idea where the GTX Neurolab is.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.